views and opinions expressed on this show or any other show on Hunco Radio Network are not necessarily those reflective of Hunco Radio owners, affiliates, or local sponsors. Any hurt feelings or mixed emotions infringing upon the PC movement should be referred to Hernco's Human Services Department, which can be reached at blah, 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 to which time you will be told to shut it. On behalf of Hernco Radio Network, I would like to take this time now to thank you from the bottom of our blackened souls. Thank you! Ha, 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 ha!
Ah, it is so good to see you again, sir. I see you have brought your friends with you this time. Very good, sir. Would you like your usual table? Right this way then, sir. Please follow me.
Who are we kidding? We're not that stuffy.
I knew I was being threatened. Do you think it's worth holding out? I mean, I've heard some pretty ugly things about those guys. Ugly stories. Watch them.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for Politics Cafe, where we sit down and discuss anything and everything. No holds barred. Bring any topic to the table. We don't care. We'll discuss it. Come on in. Sit down. Take a load off. Now, the host of the show, Mark.
Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, and fellow conversationalists around the world, and welcome once again to the Politics Cafe at www.hernco.com, the best in internet talk radio. The Politics Cafe is a small cafe located on an isolated stretch of the information superhighway, where we get together once a week and grill up some fresh topics for your digestion. Yeah, we got some topics here tonight, folks. No doubt about it. The Supreme Court, a landmark ruling, further upholding the Second Amendment rights of all of us Americans to keep and bear arms, especially now in the home. This is going to be a toughie here, folks. And I got a lot to report on that. We got other good things. The U.S. has busted a Cold War era Russian spy ring. Robert Byrd died today, and much more. You just gotta love it. The U.S. lawmakers out here demanding major oil firms emergency plans. There's another one. I'll tell you what, folks. There is more more lunacy coming from the left, and a little bit of some straight talk and some straight thinking coming from the right over here. That it's a wonderful night. Well, I want to thank everybody for showing up here tonight. Got a little room cooking here. My buddy Pox is here. My friend Natalie is here. We've got a warrior gal online here with some news from New York City. She's actually over in the Palatine microphone to work. Brand new computer. Sometimes these things happen. They're a little tough to find your way around. I've heard some of the folks out there with Windows 7, as much as they love it, it does take a little getting used to. But it's a wonderful night. It's hotter than hell up here in the Berkshires, folks. Very, very sticky. It's a good thing this is radio. You wouldn't want to see what I was wearing right now, which is damn near next to nothing with my big old cooled iced tea, fans blowing on me, all the good stuff. Yeah. It's not so much it's hot, I guess, but you can say that it's sticky. All right, starting out here. Well, first we got to, of course, go down and talk a little bit about the gun control ruling. Now, I got this one down off of the AFP, which is almost making it to the middle of the road on this. And I do have a little bit to read to you right from the decision itself, which I think is which is amazing. The U.S. Supreme Court found today a Chicago handgun ban to be unconstitutional on a far-reaching ruling that makes it much harder for states and city governments to limit gun ownership. And a major victory for gun rights activists, but a bitter blow for those seeking to maintain gun control in the United States. Justice Samuel Alito was clear on the right to bear arms for self-defense. The 5-4 majority ruling extended to all cities and states the Supreme Court's 2008 landmark affirmation that Americans have the constitutional right, as enshrined in the Second Amendment, to own weapons, including handguns. The National Rifle Association hailed the ruling, saying it marks a great moment in American history. The decision, said the NRA, is a vindication for the great majority of American citizens who have always believed the Second Amendment was an individual right and freedom worth defending. Gun control advocates responded by immediately slamming the court's move, pointing to statistics that show on average 30,000 deaths, including some 12,000 murders, by shooting each year in the United States, where, according to some estimates, 200 million guns are in circulation. Now, these people got to think about what they're writing here. Look, there's 200 million gun owners in this country. You make no mistake about that. But 200 million of them in circulation, that's pushing it a little bit. Local CBS News in Chicago said at least 29 people were shot over the weekend in the city, three fatally. A weekend earlier, between Friday night and Monday morning, the Chicago Sun-Times said 54 people were shot, 10 of whom died. In response to the decision, the Washington-based Violence Policy Center stated, matter of fact, people will die because of this decision. The ruling charged VPC's legislative director, Kirsten Rand, was a victory only for the gun lobby and America's fading firearms industry. Geez, I didn't know that was fading. But, Alito argued, the right to keep and bear arms is not the only constitutional right that has controversial public safety implications. Since the 2008 ruling reaffirmed individual gun ownership rights, a case originating out of the nation's capital, called the District of Columbia versus Heller, sites with strict gun laws such as Chicago have resisted the decision. They argued the court had not made clear that the Second Amendment of principle applied to local laws and states. But today, the top court upheld the appeal gun rights activists had lodged against Chicago's 28-year handgun ban, ruling as unconstitutional the restrictions and other registration obstacles they said impeded gun ownership. The court acknowledged that the Bill of Rights, the Constitution's first 10 amendments, originally applied only to the federal government. But it ruled that the 14th Amendment, now don't forget the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment was the one that gave former slaves its citizenship rights. Don't forget the 13th Amendment, banished slavery. But the 14th Amendment qualified them all as citizens. And I will get into this because he does argue this is, and it was part of the ruling, it was actually part of the case itself. The court nevertheless employed a key caveat against the possibility of total restriction of gun controls. The right to keep and bear arms is not a right to keep and carry any weapon whatsoever in any manner or whatsoever and for whatever purpose, wrote Alito in the majority opinion for the court's conservative bloc. Conservative bloc, give me a break. Despite gun control supporters' doomsday proclamations, Alito also insisted the decision does not imperil every law regulating firearms. The court said the 2008 ruling applied in Monday's decision did not cast doubt on long-standing gun regulations like the prohibition on felons and the mentally ill owning weapons, and laws forbidding firearms in sensitive places like schools and government buildings. The Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence said it was pleased the court reaffirmed these key points that ensure U.S. legislators were not prevented from enacting common-sense gun laws. And on and on and on. But that's... The gist of the matter is this, and actually I am going to get into it a little bit here, into the to the court ruling itself. That let's start right out. The gist of the matter is, look, your right to keep and bear arms is a right that has been guaranteed to you by the Constitution of the United States of America, which is the supreme law of the land. Now, it's let me see how they actually worded right into the beginning here. Up here it is, and it is right in the beginning. Okay, we'll start right at the top. This court held that the Second Amendment protects the right to keep and bear arms for the purpose of self-defense and struck down a District of Columbia law that banned the possession of handguns in the home. Chicago, here and after City, and the village of Oak Park, a Chicago suburb, have laws effectively banning handgun possession by almost all private citizens. Now, after Heller, petitioners filed this federal suit against the city, which was consolidated with two related actions, alleging that the city's handgun ban has left them vulnerable to criminals. They sought a declaration that the ban and several related city ordinances violate the Second and 14th Amendments. Rejecting petitioners' argument that the ordinances are unconstitutional, the court noted that the Seventh Circuit previously had upheld the constitutionality of a handgun ban, that Heller had explicitly refrained from opining on whether the Second Amendment applies to the states, and that the court had a duty to follow established court precedent. The Seventh Court affirmed, relying on three 19th century cases, which I don't really want to get into all of this, But to get down to the meat of it, which I believe is on page 13, and I skimmed through this today, folks. I'm going to be honest with you. I have not had a chance to read the whole thing. Let me see here. There was an alternative theory regarding the relationship between the Bill of Rights and Section 1 of the 14th Amendment was championed long ago by a guy named Justice Black. The theory held that first part of the 14th Amendment totally incorporated all of the provisions of the Bill of Rights. Now, as Justice Black noted, the chief congressional proponents of the 14th Amendment espoused the view that the amendment made the Bill of Rights applicable to the states and in so doing overruled damn near every other court case prior to this banning handguns and everything else along with it. Now, while that theory was never adopted, the court eventually moved in his direction by initiating what had been called a process of selective incorporation, i.e., the court began to hold that the Due Process Clause fully incorporates particular rights contained in the first 8 amendments. And he goes on to explain quite a bit in here. He said, the decisions during this time abandoned 3 of the previously noted characteristics that were given earlier. The court made it clear that the governing standard is not whether any civilized system can be imagined that would not accord the particular protection. Instead, the court inquired whether a particular Bill of Rights guarantee is fundamental to our scheme of ordered liberty and system of justice. The court also shed any reluctance to hold that rights guaranteed by the Bill of Rights met the requirements for the protection under the Due Process Clause. The court eventually incorporated almost all of the provisions of the Bill of Rights. Only a handful of the Bill of the Rights protections remain unincorporated. Finally, the court abandoned the notion that the 14th Amendment applies to the states only a watered-down subjective version of the individual guarantee of the Bill of Rights, stating that it would be incongruous to apply different standards depending on whether the claim was asserted in a state or federal court. And that was pretty much what he's saying here. He said the rights and protections under it are all to be enforced against the states under the 14th Amendment according to the same standards to protect those personal rights against federal encroachment. And that's what it's basically when the 14th Amendment, and believe it or not, folks, the 14th Amendment didn't just make citizens out of former slaves. All right, if you read the 14th Amendment, it's all persons born or naturalized into here are citizens of the United States of America. And what that does is it extends jurisdiction over everyone, all right, by the federal government. And, you know, which is, you know, a lot of people will argue today that's something we never should have adopted because later on it gave them the right to tax you and blah, 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 blah. However, it did, you know, once you became that citizen, those first 8 rights in the Bill of Rights were incorporated into it. And basically, they were upheld, which meant that a state could not move against you because of the supreme law of the land, the federal laws, and in particular, in this case, the Second Amendment. You know, your right to keep and bear firearms. Now, he goes on to write here that throughout the South, armed parties, often consisting of ex-Confederate soldiers serving in the state militias, forcibly took firearms from newly freed slaves. In the first session of the 39th Congress, Senator Wilson told his colleagues, in Mississippi rebel state forces, men who were in the rebel armies are traversing the state, visiting the freedmen, disarming them, perpetrating murders and outrages upon them, and the same things are done in other sections of the country. Now, the report on the Joint Committee on Reconstruction, which was widely reprinted in the press and distributed by members of the 39th Congress to their constituents shortly after Congress approved the 14th Amendment, contained numerous examples of such abuses. And in one town, the marshal himself took all the arms from returned colored soldiers and was very prompt in shooting the blacks whenever an opportunity occurred. Senator Wilson put it during the debate on a failed proposal to disband Southern militias. There is one unbroken chain of testimony from all people that are loyal to this country, that the greatest outrages are perpetrated by armed men who go up and down the country searching houses, disarming people, committing outrages of every kind and description. People act like this has never happened here, but I'm telling you, folks, if something like that has happened here before, it can happen again. Union Army commanders took steps to secure the right of all citizens to keep and bear arms, but the 39th Congress concluded that the legislative action was necessary. Its efforts to safeguard the right to keep and bear arms demonstrate that the right was still recognized to be fundamental. Now, as a matter of fact, here, Limey Buster, no, we're not talking about the Civil War. We are talking about the right to keep and bear firearms, one that is guaranteed to all Americans by the Second Amendment to our Constitution, which is the supreme law of the land. And what we're going on here, now, you know, as I had mentioned earlier, just in case you just popped in here, is that this lawsuit was brought against the city of Chicago, Illinois, by McDonald et al. Not only that the gun laws in there were violating their rights under the Second Amendment, but was also violating their rights as citizens under the 14th Amendment. And it's a, Limey Buster, it's a wonderful thing that you don't need a gun. My guns sit in the closet and they're actually gathering dust. Once in a while I clean them out and make sure that they're operational, but that's a fine thing. I'm glad to hear that. But the fact of the matter is here, an unarmed populace is subject to anything, to the whims of anyone with a firearm coming along. What are you going to do against one if you don't have one? That is the key point here. Keeping firearms in your home for the protection of your home, your goods, your family, your loved ones, your possessions has always been a fundamental right. And it's a fundamental right to be kept, as Samuel Alito puts here, to have a free society. It's, you can't have one without it. It's basically that simple. If people are unarmed and defenseless, then anybody can come along and do whatever. You know, look, Thomas Jefferson once said that when the people fear the government, there is tyranny. When the government fear the people, there is liberty. I would have you note there, Mr. Limey Buster, that on all of our coins, there is one little seven-letter word stamped on all of them, and it is called liberty. All right. Now, this is not what happens, not merely restricted, I should say, to sailors who are on leave from their ship. Okay, the word liberty means freedom of man from men. That's a very important right, and it's a very important kind of thing. Needs to be upheld, needs to be thought about, needs to be talked about once in a while, because a lot of people just forget what the whole idea of liberty is. You know, you talk to a lot of people up here in my area, in the liberal left-leaning end of Western Massachusetts, and they're all going, liberty, oh yeah, that's sailors get that when they go to port, don't they? I said, what, you think sailors are the only people that use coins? You know why we put that on there? That freedom of man from men, that case of liberty is the one that has to be made and has to be constantly being brought up. Because if not, you have the liberal left in this country who believe that, you know, despite anything anybody says, we are all enslaved to each other. You know, we are all connected to each other. We are all dependent upon one another. Well, I'll tell you something. It's one thing to say that you are in a state of dependency upon your fellow human beings. But that does not give you the right, in any manner whatsoever, you know, to claim that, you know, you all of a sudden have a right to fellow human beings' production, your fellow human beings' time, your fellow human beings' possessions. None of that. None of that whatsoever. You know, that's what this is all about. That's what the whole idea of liberty is. And being able to protect these things in a very basic way, by yourself if need be, has to be included in those fundamental rights to protect it. That's all there is to it. You know, it's a wonderful thing. Mr. Limey Buster, I'm glad to hear that you have no need to fire a weapon. That's a wonderful thing. God bless you. And I'm glad you live in a place where that happens. And may God grant you the peace and serenity that you may never have to. Unfortunately, my friend, though, this world is full of miscreants. Make no mistake about it. The prisons are full of them, and in a liberal country like this one, they tend to let them out every now and then when they can't afford to keep them. And a lot of times, some of them manage to escape getting into that prison system altogether. But the fact of the matter is, you know, look, let's face it, bud. All right, God created all men. Sam Colt made them all equal. That's how that works. All right. Just so you folks know, I mean, this is it's a wonderful thing that's happened here today. I think you're going to see more and more of these court cases coming up here. And I'll tell you what could be really tink. Now, I might be wrong on this. I've made predictions in the past that have come out wrong, obviously. But I'm predicting here that you're going to see more and more of these cases start hitting the court. And it may come to a point to where the court feels a little overwhelmed by these and turns around and says to the legislature, You know, we're not going to change this Constitution. We can't. We're not in a position to. So it's, you know, it's a part here. Maybe to, you know, make sure that everybody understands this, you know, and start doing something about it on the federal level. It's, because, you know, states will act, you know, outside of the scope of federal level. I mean, they always could. Like, states have their own sovereignty. And, you know, obviously what's going on here. I mean, I look at what happens up here in Massachusetts. You know, we've got a very, very heavy gun laws up here. Make no mistake about it. It's not hard to get a permit here in Massachusetts if you have never committed a crime. Make no mistake about that. They really will not deny you one. Well, they do qualify them all now as being only for hunting and target only. However, that basically thing is, you know, from what I understand with whatnot, it's meaningless. You know, if you have a gun in your car and you have the proper identification for it, it's fine. You know, one of the things that's pretty crazy up here in Massachusetts is the fact that we do not have any concealed carry weapons laws. It's that's something you got to think about. Now, when I went to get my gun permit years ago, they had they come right out and told us this. Says, listen, you know, look, a lot of states out there, if you travel into another state, they will probably honor your gun card, you know, your firearms identification card. Your firearms permit, but they may not honor the fact that here in Massachusetts we recommend that you carry it concealed. There's a lot of other states out there do have concealed weapons laws. The state of Pennsylvania is the first one that comes to mind. In the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, I should say, you can walk down the street with a loaded shotgun, as long as it is in full view and everyone can see it. But once you've taken that shotgun and placed it under your coat, you have broken the law. You know, once you have concealed that shotgun, then all of a sudden, you are in trouble. Crazy thing. All right, moving on and on. I don't have a lot of time tonight. I got tons of stuff to cover. Let's kick back here a little bit. And there's definitely one I wanted to get away. Well, here's a quick one we can get to maybe before the break. This is funny. Senior U.S. lawmaker study. By the way, this is down at the AFP. And as always, the usual disclaimer, all articles read on this program are for informational, educational, and discussion purposes only, not to be construed as anything else. Senior U.S. lawmakers today pressed oil giants Chevron, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and Shell to prove they are better prepared than BP was in the Gulf of Mexico to confront a massive oil spill. No oil company appears to be better prepared for a disastrous oil spill than BP was. House Energy and Commerce Committee Chairman Henry Waxman and the chairman of two subcommittees wrote in a letter to top executives at each firm. Our view is that the MOF should be reinstated until the oil companies can demonstrate that their oil response plans are capable of protecting the Gulf region from another subsea blowout. A U.S. judge ruled last week against President Barack Obama's 6-month freeze on deepwater drilling in the Gulf, a decision the White House immediately said it would appeal. At a hearing earlier this month, the executives acknowledged that their emergency response plans were in large part similar to BP's plan for managing a major spill in the Gulf, which events proved catastrophically inadequate. The lawmakers asked the oil firms to advise the committee no later than July 2nd, whether their oil spill response plans for the Gulf of Mexico were similar to the one at the blown-out Macondo well, and explain how they reached their conclusions. They also have resources or equipment available in the event of a spill that were not currently being used to respond to the disaster in the Gulf. Yeah. And they asked whether the major firms plan to revise their emergency response plans, and if so, by when. Now, here's the kicker, folks. Something you got to think about right here. There are a lot of stuff that could be done happening down in the Gulf right now. There are Dutch ships sitting, standing on, waiting to get permission to come down and help them out, Dutch skimmers. There are skimmers at other ports around this country that could be moved down there to help clean up this oil spill, to help contain it. All right, they are being told to stay in their docks just in case something happens there. Now, this is kind of ludicrous the way I look at it. And the fact that they're holding off these Dutch ships and other help that is being offered from around the world. And, hey, let's stop and think about something here, folks. This is one of the few times in the history of this country that we have had a disaster that other countries have actually offered their aid. You know, and that's something you really got to look at. We didn't get any aid offers like this after 9/11 or after numerous other disasters. We didn't get any aid, you know, offers of aid after Katrina. you know, after Hurricane Ivan, after a number of things that have hit the Gulf Coast in the last 50 years. But all of a sudden, here it is, you know. People want to, Christ, if for nothing else, they want to prove the effectiveness of what it is they're able to do when everybody gets together. Well, everybody's in a means of willing to get together. You idiots on the left out there are constantly telling us, we need to unite, we need to get stronger, we need to do... Look, here is your big chance to prove whether or not you really want to see everybody unite. All right? Now, for my two cents to add to this, for these idiot lawmakers who are looking for better preparedness for drilling out in the ocean... Why don't you idiots stop and think about drilling on land? Why don't you stop and think about opening up the Bakken oil reserves? Why don't you stop and think about opening up the North Slope? Why don't you stop and think about drilling back in this country? Here, call Corey. You should call for it. Yes, take it. And it's that's the way I see it, folks. I mean, they really need to just turn around and look. With all the oil wells that are being capped off all around this country, you know, with all the restrictions on exploration, with all the, hoops that they have to jump through in order to drill in this country, I'm sorry, forcing them out to sea the way they did, you know, with the permission and the, I can't think of the word that I'm looking for here, but, you know, with the advocacy of our government behind them pushing us out there, yeah, I'm sorry. But this is a huge blunder. This administration owes this blunder. Make no mistake about it. And if it keeps getting worse, they're going to own something that's even worse and may become irreparable. At any rate, we're at the bottom of the hour here, and I've got to take a short break. Folks, take a gander over to www.hernco.com. Take a look through the gift section and other good things. Listen to the commercials, and we'll be right back. You are listening to the Politics Cafe with me. My name is Mark Belcher, and we'll be right back after these short messages.
Your classmate receiving an attachment of you posing in your underwear. Your ex-boyfriend forwarding the picture to his friends. It being sent to your coach. And worst of all, your dad. All because of the time you posted those pictures on your profile. Anything you post online, anyone can see. So think before you post. For more information, visit www.cybertipline.com.
Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Justice, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and the Ad Council.
Janine Marks, a 12-year-old, was fairly normal. She spent a lot of time online. One day, she met a new friend. The new friend had the same problems at home. They liked the same bands. They worried about the same subjects in school. They promised to keep each other's secrets. They wished they went to the same junior high. The new friend had good news. He said he was going to be in Janine's area one Saturday. He thought it would be amazing if they could just hang out, go to the mall. Janine agreed. The new friend didn't want parents messing this up. Janine showed up alone. So did her new friend, who wasn't in junior high, wasn't nice, and wasn't a 14-year-old boy. Every day, children are sexually solicited online. Help delete online predators. Call 1-800-THE-LOST or visit cybertipline.com to learn how to protect your kids' online life. A message from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the Ad Council.
This next question is for Caroline. Caroline, if you take the bus 60 miles to school at 5:30 a.m. and the bus is traveling at an average of 30 miles per hour, how are you going to get to your prenatal appointment and still make it to homeroom on time?
Some students are tackling more than just their schoolwork, which is why more than 30% of them aren't graduating. But you can give them the boost they need to make it through by visiting boostup.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
And we're back. You're listening to the Politics Cafe at www.hernco.com, the best in internet talk radio. All right, I got the scoop on one of them here. You're going to be hearing about tomorrow. 10 alleged Russian secret agents were arrested. Hit the press about 5 minutes before the show came on. Right. The FBI, no disclaimer by the AP, sorry, by Pete Yost and Tom Hayes. Can't forget that. The FBI has arrested 10 people for allegedly serving for years as secret agents of Russia's intelligence service, the SVR, with the goal of penetrating U.S. government policy-making circles. According to court papers unsealed Monday, the FBI intercepted a message from SVR headquarters, Moscow Center, to two of the defendants describing their main mission as to search and develop ties in policy-making circles in the U.S. Intercepted messages showed they were asked to learn about a broad swath of topics including nuclear weapons, U.S. arms control positions, Iran, White House rumors, CIA leadership turnover, the last presidential election, the Congress, and political parties. I don't know what the hell they needed spies for there. They could get the New York Times. I'm sure they sell it over there. After a secret multi-year investigation, the Justice Department announced the arrest today in a blockbuster spy case that could rival the capture of Soviet Colonel Rudolf Abel in 1957 in New York. There was no clue in initial court papers how successful the agents had been, but they were alleged to have been long-term deep-cover spies, some living as couples. These deep cover agents are the hardest spies for the FBI to catch because they take civilian jobs with no visible connection to a foreign government, rather than operating from government jobs inside Russian embassies and military missions. Abel was just such a deep cover agent. He was ultimately swapped to the Soviet Union for U-2 spy pilot Francis Gary Powers in 1962. The court papers described a new high-tech spy-to-spy communication system used by the defendants, short-range wireless communication between laptop computers, a modern supplement for the old-style dead drop in a remote area, high-speed burst radio transmission, or even the hollowed-out nickels used by Colonel Abel to conceal and deliver microfilm. 8 of the 10 were arrested Sunday for allegedly carrying out long-term deep-cover assignments in the United States on behalf of Russia. 2 others were arrested for allegedly participating in the same Russian intelligence program within the United States. An 11th defendant who allegedly delivered money to the defendants is at large. The court papers cited numerous communications intercepted in the FBI probe that had spelled out what the 10 allegedly were trying to do. The timing of the arrest was notable given the efforts by President Barack Obama and Dmitry Medvedev to reset U.S.-Russian relations. The two leaders met just last week at the White House after Medvedev visited high-tech firms in California's Silicon Valley, and both attended the G8, G20 meetings over the weekend in Canada. You gotta love it. See, this is what I mean. Why did they have spies here? You know? Obama took them right into Silicon Valley. What did he need to have spies for? Intelligence on Obama's foreign policy positions, particularly towards Russia, appears to have been a top priority for alleged spies. Yeah, I'll bet. That's a good one. I'll tell you what. You know, if they were doing anything, you're probably selling it to the RNC. In the spring of 2009, the documents say, alleged conspirators Richard and Cynthia Murphy, who lived in New Jersey, were asked by Moscow for information related to Obama's impending trip to Russia that summer. They were asked to learn about the U.S. negotiating position on the START Arms Reduction Treaty, as well as Afghanistan and the approach Washington would take in dealing with Iran's suspect nuclear program, the document said. They were also asked to send background on U.S. officials who would be traveling with Obama or involved in foreign policy, try to outline their views, and most important, Obama's goals and which he expects to achieve during summit in July. And how does his team plan to do it? Arguments, provisions, means of persuasion to lure Russia into cooperating with U.S. interests? Moscow asked, according to the documents. Moscow indicated that it needed intelligence reports, which should reflect approaches and ideas of four sub-cabinet U.S. policy official. Murphy had several work-related personal meetings with a man in the court, papers described as a prominent New York-based financier who was active in politics. Ew, this is going to get stinky, folks. In response, intelligence headquarters in Moscow described the man as a very interesting target and urged the defendants to try to build up a little by little relations. Maybe he can provide Murphy with remarks to U.S. foreign policy, rumors about the White House internal kitchen, invite her to venues, to major political party headquarters in New York City, for instance. In short, carefully consider all options in regard to the financier. Now, this is going to get funny. Now, folks, I don't have to go on any further with this. We just heard it all here. All right, they're trying to get themselves close to a financier. You know, a phone call to Tim Geithner or Larry Summers probably would have found out everything they needed to know. You know, these people are never reluctant to just spill their guts on everything. I mean, what the hell? You know, Obama went right to Afghanistan and told them when we were going to be building up forces, you know, when they would be deployed, how things were going to work out. You just got to love it. You know, these people have nothing to hide. Well, they might have had a few things that they should have hidden, but haven't. You know, of course, you could have called Robert Gibbs at the White House. I'm sure he would have blurted everything. Hell, I think if they had just showed up and said, hi, we are from SVR, you know, and said, yeah, we're just a newspaper, they would have been admitted right to the White House press room and had been able to ask all the questions they wanted. Probably would have gotten as straight an answer as everybody else gets in there, too. I just got to love it. But this should go on further. I'm waiting to see who this New York financier is. Now, personally, I think since this has hit the news the way it is, the New York financier who is going to be approached here will probably be the one that will be shown to have blown the whistle on the whole operation and brought it out to such light that the FBI could no longer contain their 10-year investigation into this. Yeah, you just got to love it. Just gotta love it, folks. But this will get further. All right, moving onwards here. I should probably get into the new Supreme Court justice here, but there's more to go on here. This is one I really want to talk about. Now, this one is down off of CQ Politics. Now, Senate Democratic leaders are pressing ahead with plans for floor action on the final version of legislation to overhaul the financial services industry. Despite a likely Republican filibuster and today's death of West Virginia Democrat Robert C. Byrd. Now, even before Byrd's death, the Democrats appeared short of the 60 votes needed to take up the conference report on a financial overhaul. The negotiators completed it early June 24th. Massachusetts Republican Senator Scott P. Brown, one of four Republicans who supported the Senate version of the bill when it was passed, 59-39, on May 20th, has voiced opposition to the final version that emerged from a conference committee, citing concerns about the addition of a tax on banks. The three other GOP supporters of the Senate-based passed bill were Charles E. Grassley of Iowa and Olympia J. Snow and Susan Collins of Maine. Well, you could have expected that. Democratic leaders were preparing for the likelihood of a Republican filibuster of the conference report, Senate aides said today. The Senate is expected to take up the conference report immediately after the House adopts it. The House remains on track to debate the conference report tomorrow or Wednesday, said aides to House leader, Majority Leader Steny Hoyer. Now, Byrd and Arlen Specter, I think I had marked as independent of Pennsylvania, who are they kidding, did not vote when the Senate passed its version in May, and both were expected to support the conference report. But if Brown votes no on a procedural motion, Democrats could still find themselves one vote short of the number needed to limit debate. And leaders would renew efforts to bring up the measure after a temporary successor to Byrd is named by Democratic West Virginia Governor Joe Manchin III. Manchin has not said when he will appoint someone to serve the remainder of Byrd's term ending in January 2013. Now, folks, there's another article on this, and I'm going to try to dig up here real quick. And it's over on the AFP, and I bet I got it here. Where is it? There's one guy holding out here, and it's Russ Feingold. And where did I stash that? Maybe I got it one more. There it is, right here. I knew I'd find it. All right, folks, it's actually down off the Reuters network. Sorry about that. Senator Russ Feingold said today that he will not vote to advance the financial reform bill, denying his fellow Democrats the 60th vote they need to clear a final hurdle in Congress. My test for the financial regulatory bill is whether it will prevent another crisis, Feingold said in a prepared statement. This bill fails that test, and for that reason, I will not vote to advance it. Unbelievable. Now, I'm going to have to go take a peek on Russ Feingold's stuff here later on to see exactly why, what he's holding out for. Personally, I think he's holding out for something else, you know. But Now, folks, I can't comment on exactly what's in the bill. I have done a search on it, and I cannot seem to find it. If any of you fine folks in the room here have a clue to it or an idea where it might be out there, I would love to get a link to it and take a peek at it. But I'm here to tell you, when these financial reform bills come down, or at least by the looks of things that have been coming down since the Obama administration has been in there, actually for the past 3 years since the Democrats took over Congress in 2006, you gotta wonder about a few things here. You know, we were supposed to be reforming insurance companies with health insurance. What do we find out? That the insurance companies are basically getting the arm of government to force people to do business with them and to push out all of their smaller competitors. I mean, you know, basically, that's exactly what's going on here. You know, we saw a financial emergency bill hit, you know, the American Economic Recovery Act, which did no more than have the government and the unions take over two of our larger car companies. You know, we saw some financial regulations that made banks, investment banks, corporate banks, now under the same guise as everybody else's bank out there, as your savings and loans and all the rest of them, which in effect did no more than extend coverage to them and raise the premiums on for the FDIC, another insurance corporation. You know, whether it's got the word federal on it or not doesn't mean a damn thing to me. It's another big corporation, you know, with insurance on it. Not that I have a problem with all big corporations, but there are a few of them out there that really get my goat. And the ones that are federally sponsored, the GSEs and whatnot, they always get my goat. Because these are people who are doing no more than cornering the market on certain things. All right? Just like the Federal Reserve managed to corner the market on the creation of currency. Managed to monetize the debt after it was in there for, you know, what, 50, 60 years. They pulled off the miracle of monetizing debt, you know, bring us to the problems that we have today in our economic sphere. I can't see this as being anything more than that. You know, folks, let me explain something to you here. A lot of people have been crying about how the free markets have been destroying everything. The free markets have just been allowing everything to get out. All these big corporations get to do what they do because of free markets. Folks, I'm here to tell you, there are no free markets out there. You can't blame this on free markets because it's just ludicrous to even think that. You know, fact of the matter is, all right, that over the last 60 years, what the banking system has managed to do in this country is to basically get it socialized by the government. It managed to socialize all of its risks and have the government back up that socialization of the risks. I mean, stop and think about a few things here. All right, savings and loan bailout. What happened during that? Well, a lot of savings and loans went down the tubes, couldn't make any money. We're all of a sudden starting to find out that their reserves were way below the federal requirements. Now, of course, you know, this same thing has occurred again, but what we're finding out is, well, the Fed says, well, you don't need that much in reserve in your banks anymore. You know, don't worry about it. Not a big deal. But the fact of the matter is, whenever one of these, you know, whenever there was a huge collapse going on in the system, who bailed them out? The taxpayers. Now, I'm sorry, folks, but I believe that this is wrong. I believe that when you go into a bank and you give Mr. Banker your hard-earned money to deposit into his bank, knowing fully that he is going to lend that money out, earn interest on it, and share that interest with you, that you are taking a risk with Mr. Banker. Mr. Banker is not going into this all alone, and you do not have any more protections than those that Mr. Banker is offering you. Now, if Mr. Banker is offering you an insurance company, well, you better understand, you know, that insurance is only going to be about as good as Mr. Banker. If Mr. Banker makes a few bad loans and goes down the tubes, well, he's taking your money with him. You went into a partnership with him when you went in there. And to ask the federal government to go out there and back you and your banker up, okay, is a crime. I believe that that is criminal because it allows Mr. Banker to take risky moves, you know, to make even foolish moves, or even, if need be, intentionally lose money to someone out there that he may favor for some reason or another. You know, even if it's going to cost him something. Who knows? Who knows why he would do this? But the fact of the matter is, it's done all the time. Banks make bad loans that do not get repaid. All right, well, who ends up paying for it? Well, we all do. We end up paying for it in a couple of different directions. A, you end up paying for it with lower interest rates on your savings. And B, and where it's more important that you end up paying for it, all right, is in the lowered purchasing value of your currency. And that is the biggest hidden thing here. That's the one that kills people, and people just don't seem to understand this. You know, when they have to be bailed out like this and they end up, you know, pumping and injecting all sorts of money into the system, well, the more money there is in there, the more diluted the system becomes, the less all of the money is actually worth. And that's the big key. You know, that's why, you know, $30,000 a year, which made you a rich person in the 70s, is barely, you know, pauper's money these days. You know, stop and think about that. You know, you go back in the 70s, you take a look, and I remember when I got out of high school, actually senior year in high school, I worked for a guy in a gas station. He was in a little spot, just him and his wife and his kid. He had a mechanic and five people working there for him. We worked different shifts, pumping gas for the customers. We had to work hard. You had to go out and pump the gas for the people. You had to check your oil. You had to wash their windshield. You had to make sure that they were happy to be there. Well, the fact of the matter is, you know, this capitalist that I used to work for, had a brand new Cadillac every 2 years, had a beautiful split branch level home up in the suburbs, smoked big cigars, had nice things, was one of the first guys to get a great big console color TV set. You know, despite the fact that it caught fire on him in his bedroom and almost burned his house down, we'll step that aside. You know, but the fact of the matter is he did all of this on $30,000 a year. Now, where does that $30,000 a year get you now? You know, you ain't buying a Cadillac on it. Forget that, because the Cadillac itself is $50,000. All right, so that ain't going to happen. You know, are you going to get your split ranch home? Hell no. Because that split ranch home that went for $40,000 back then, which you could purchase on a 20-year mortgage for a couple hundred dollars a month, can't be had, okay? Because that split ranch level home now is $450,000, and it's going to cost you about $2,500 a month to own. You know, stop and think about this here. You know, this is it's a whole different world. And this is what ends up happening here. Because we have asked the federal government to guarantee our deposits, you know, to create an insurance company, which may or may not be there. I mean, if it's just your bank goes down, yeah, no problem, the insurance company's there for it. But when you see the system starting to fall, what happens? Well, the system isn't big enough. It'll never be big enough for them to cover all of the losses that could possibly occur out there. Now, what's the other thing that could have happened here? Okay? And this is the part that really kills me about it all. You know, throughout mankind's history, using substance, using, reality for currency instead of notes of debt or promissory notes, which is all you're using out there right now. That paper money that you have is nothing more than a note. If you look at it, it says right on it, this note. What you had were you had periods of inflation and you had periods of deflation. During periods of inflation, alright, when the prices of goods and services went up because there was too much money in the system, alright, it would, what you would end up with is those who created that money, the miners, the refiners, the mints and whatnot, would end up closing down because they couldn't make a profit on the money that they were creating. And that, my friends, would put a halt to the money that was being injected into any society. Now, as society would continue to grow, there would be a need for more money. Because what you would find would be a period of deflation. Money gets scarce, people try to sell their goods and services for anything they can get for them. Alright? That's what happens here. This is what you call a period of deflation. Now, during a period of deflation, things tend to get a little better for everybody. You can start affording things again with the meager amount of money that you are making. You know, things start to become more into touch, more things that you can get your hands on. Foodstuffs, everything else becomes a little bit cheaper. Alright, and once that all happens and the value of your money starts increasing, well, the mines would open back up and you would have, you know, those guys would all be going back to work producing more money that was necessary in society. So what you had were periods of inflation that were checked by periods of deflation. And you had periods of deflation that were checked by periods of inflation. But you don't have that anymore because they have taken the check and balance of deflation out of the system. It's gone. It doesn't exist anymore. Okay? And there's a big reason for this, okay? Because when deflation occurs, banks do not get paid back on their loans. I know, you got to look at what's happening currently around the country right here today. Yeah, a couple weeks ago, maybe a month, I don't know, 3 weeks, I reported right here on the show how a lot of banks out there are reducing, or not banks, but a lot of manufacturers are reducing their inventories, you know, which actually made the economic output look a little better. You know, when looked at durable goods that were actually being moved around, a lot more of them were being sold. But what was not mentioned was the prices that they were being sold for and how the sales were going about. A lot of this was being liquidated, and it was because the manufacturers could not meet their payments. They had to, look, you got to keep your people working, all right? If you can't keep your people working because you don't, you're not getting orders in, well, you're going to start laying people off. But you still have got to get rid of your stuff. You've got to keep whatever money you can flowing. Well, that's the big point. See, during periods of deflation, banks end up losing. People do not get enough money for their goods and services in order to pay off their bank loans. And instead, it goes to other necessities. Food. The immediate necessity is food, clothing, housing, things that you got to have on a day-to-day basis that you need money for and will not get it without it. I mean, it's that simple. The last guy I end up holding the bag here is going to be the banker. Well, that is exactly what banking laws and what the Federal Reserve and the inception of everything else that's occurred since then, monetizing debt, has been designed to prevent. Okay? It is the bankers who have co-opted the federal government to ensure that this country never has an inflationary check by a deflationary period. Now, what's the result of all this? You know? Well, stop and think about this. You know, you hear people all the time crying, well, and here's the big argument. You hear people on the left saying, all them companies are leaving and going to China just so they can save money on getting cheaper labor. And the people on the right are saying, all those companies are leaving and going to China because of high taxes. Well, the fact of the matter is, folks, they're going for both reasons. For both reasons. And you cannot blame them. But you got to ask yourself a couple of things. Why is the labor so high? It's not because the American worker is so expensive. It's because the money that you're paying him in isn't worth shit. That is the big problem. That's why he needs more of it on an ever-increasing basis just to stay alive. Now, is that fair? Is that right? No. It's wrong because he's playing a game of catch-up throughout his entire life. Throughout the life of an entire industry, both he and his employer are constantly playing a game of catch-up. And it's a game that can't be won. That's the point. And the reason that the game can't be won is because it is not a free market. It is because the game has been rigged. And that, my friends, is the big point that I'm trying to make here tonight. He's trying to let you know that this is not going to change things. These federal regulations that are going to be advanced here, and hopefully between tonight and next week's show, I will have a copy of the bill, and we'll tear right through it, and we'll go line by line to see exactly what's going on here, just as I did with the health insurance bill that allowed all the insurance companies to start getting their digs into the government, start allowing them to co-opt the government and the arm of government that is an enforcement arm called the IRS to force people to deal with them. Alright? We're basically in the same position with our currency that we have been for a long, long time. You are no longer dealing with the United States Treasury. You are dealing with the Federal Reserve and the Central Bank. And it's not a pretty situation, folks. You can see where it's at. I mean, look at where we are at today. You know, unemployment levels, you know, gross unemployment up around, what, 17-18%? You got a stock market that's starting to drip again on a daily basis. You know, get people out of work and expenses going through the roof. You know, I'm here to tell you, just over the last year, I have watched my food bill, you know, go up 20-25%. You know, I got a small family. I still only got two kids left at home. That's it. And our food bill has gone from $200 to $300 a week. You know, I'm sorry, but hey, there's something wrong here. You know, when I start seeing turkeys in the store at Christmas time for $50, we got a problem. When you go in there and finally find a decent cut of roast beef in there, a nice roast that you can take home and put in the oven that has more than a $50 price tag on it, you got a problem. You got a huge problem. And you're going to ask one of the families out there that's earning $30,000 a year to be able to afford this? First, they're damn lucky to be able to afford rice and beans at this point in time. Now, this is heading somewhere, folks. It's getting ugly. And I'm here to tell you. I'm going to have to absolutely take a look at what Russ Feingold's talking about here. And see exactly where he's going. Maybe we can get him on the air for an interview next week. I might be working out here. I haven't done an interview in a long time. That could be a good one to get on board. And maybe some of the other guys. Maybe we'll get Scott Brown in here, too. At any rate, good people to talk to over this weekend to see what the hell is going on. Scott Brown, as we read from the article there, is worried about a tax on the banks. You know? Yeah. There's obvious reasons why you may or may not want to do that. Me personally, yes, I would be taxing everybody. But you've all heard my tax spiel many, many times in the past. Maybe we'll go through that again next week, too. At any rate, folks, I have hit the top of the hour here, and it's time once again to close up shop. As always, Mater D is running around and taking care of the last final effects here. But the tables have all been piled high with the chairs. The lights are growing dim. And the cafe is going to come to a close. However, the bar will be open. There will be plenty of drinks being served. And folks are invited to hang around right here at Politics Lobby 4, Patriots Unite Voice Room on Pal Talk. And over on HearnCo.com, there's going to be more shows coming your way. So, folks, stay tuned. But have a good night and have a pleasant weekend. We will see you next week. Good night from the Politics Cafe at www.hernco.com. The best in Internet talk radio. Good night, folks.